What is going on, guys? So you already know what it is. It is me, your boy Brandon Gross, and your other boy Ryan Warner here at Design Huddle, and we are super stoked for a very special guest. So before we introduce him, we're going to get into a little bit of his background so you guys can have some context. So he's built industry-defining products for the likes of Netflix, Google, Facebook, Huawei, Twitter, The Weather Channel, Adobe, Microsoft, British Airways, HP, and 23andMe. And guys, that's the short list. He's a regular host and speaker at international design events such as the Award Conference, Smashing Conference, UX London, as well as speaking at the likes of Google, Microsoft, and Twitter. He's an amazing author and industry writer and has been interviewed by several large media publications on his success, work, and just to name a few of these, Design Taxi, Fast Company, The Daily Mail, Slate Magazine, NPR, The Next Web, and many more. He works at the amazing global human-centered design firm Fantasy, where he's building pioneering products with the world's brightest. So please, ladies and gentlemen, help us welcome futurist, speaker, adventurer, and deserted island survivor, the global head of product.
Let's go.
Peter Smart, what's good?
Hi, everyone. How's it going? That was quite the intro. I love the little island reference thrown in at the end there.
This is a podcast.
We do our research here.
There's strobe lights and there's smoke coming from the stage.
I love it.
We don't mess around.
I'm running out into the auditorium, high-fiving everybody. What's up, everyone?
Hell yeah.
It's great to be here, guys. Thanks for having me on.
Of course. All right, so we have a serious question before we even get into things,
okay,
my man.
Okay, go for it.
So I understand what it's like to have a very interesting last name. I very much introduce myself as my name is Brandon Gross, as in nasty. You'll never forget it. But Smarty is another thing. I was listening to one of your talks, and I already hear. I feel you. There was a name that I was laughing for 5 minutes straight because I couldn't get over it. Smarty Farty. How does one child defend himself
against
such a name?
Yeah, no, I mean, having the name Smart as a kid was, just a blessing and a curse, you know? People think you're automatically going to be intelligent, but oh my goodness, yeah, Smarty Farty, smart ass. No, it was relentless, man. I think now I'm older and you walk into a room and you say your name's Peter Smart, I think it comes with a certain degree of respect, you know? But I don't think 7-year-old kids have that same respect.
Yeah, I think you've lived up to the hype, which is good.
I don't know. I'm 27. I will totally take a smart fart. That's like AI of the next level. But anyway, we're gonna scoot over that. Everybody just gloss over that. We're gonna get into some real good stuff here with Pete. So yeah, me and Ryan are super excited. And we really just want to chat with you, and we know you do amazing work, but we want to get behind the scenes of the, you know, the intelligence, the your work that you have out there with your team. So we want to roll back the tape on your creative career and just, you know, lay it out for us. Where did you start? Where was like day one for the beginning of your career?
So what I'm doing today is awesome, right? I'm working with this amazing team. I'm working with incredible companies, and it all seems super glamorous. I think when I first started, it was definitely not glamorous. I think guys, like, picture like a 15-year-old little kid in a suit and a skateboard and a dream. Like, that was me, age 15. And honestly, I think I was just like a kid out of Stranger Things. But that little that little image is literally me. Like, that is how I started my design career, genuinely. Like, I was this artsy, stupid little artsy kid, and I discovered Photoshop. And I thought I could design and I could make stuff. And so honestly, like, no one would pay me to do anything. And so I would just make stuff. I would make up businesses and I would make up events so that I could design the logos and the flyers for those events. And they always had really stupid names, like Paradigm Shift Limited. Like, really, really dumb names that I thought sounded really, really cool.
Really edgy,
yeah,
out
like
here.
Edgy names. Yeah, yeah. Like, literally, I had like no experience, but like, I was just like super passionate about design. And I remember just being young enough that the world hadn't slapped me around in the face yet, that I didn't really care what anyone else thought. And so I genuinely would put on a suit, like literally like a little businessman, like a little entrepreneur. And I would skateboard around my Hope Town in Bonny, England. And I would just walk into stores. And honest, I'll tell you the story of my first ever client, if you're interested. The first ever client I had was my local butcher shop. And I walk into his store, and literally my heart is like racing. And I walk up to this guy who's literally been in the community for like 15 years. And I walk up to him and I say, in my little like 15-year-old voice, like, I don't think you have a very good logo. can I redesign it for you? And he was my first ever client, the butcher, like at my local stores. And I think I just had this, I don't know, like tenacity. And that's where I began. And I just kept doing that. And that was me age 15. And somehow that turned into me running an agency. Somehow that turned into like bigger and bigger clients. And I think that same like childhood exuberance and passion to put my heart into everything just kind of followed me for like every pitch and every project. And yeah, I mean, it led me to do some pretty crazy things. You mentioned, you know, like adventures that I've been on in my time. And I think I just continued to get into like bigger and bigger adventures, bigger and bigger clients. I'll tell you a story. There's a project, I don't know if you know about it, but it's one that I think really was a bit of a career definer for me, where I decided that I wanted to get to know other design studios. I discovered this thing called design thinking for the first time. And I was my mind was blown by, because I was doing flyers and websites and flash using like Macromedia, like that was me. But then discovering this thing called design thinking, where you could use design to solve actual problems for people beyond like creating throwaway flyers, I just thought everything I'd done to that point felt almost trivial, like unbelievable. So I really wanted to get connected into studios and to people who were like experts in this. And so I thought I had to do something big. Like what can I do that's gonna get my name out there and give me an opportunity or a way in to meet these people? And so I decided that I was gonna try and solve 50 problems in 50 days using design thinking and see what I could do. And so I traveled 2,500 miles around Europe, and every single day for 50 consecutive days, I tried to solve a human problem using design thinking. And it was like really big things or really, really small things. And then I met all these amazing design studios, but I put this project up online. And I think that was really when my career went into that like next phase. You know, I was running an agency through like 15, 16, 17, like I was into like my early 20s. And then I think I, you know, by doing this project and putting my neck out there a little bit more, it turned into that next phase. But yeah, I hope that sounds like an interesting prelude. But you know, obviously many twists and turns since. But yeah, no, here today in San Francisco, leading the amazing Fantasy Interactive, which is just a dream role to be in for sure.
Yeah, I want to. That's an awesome overview, Peter. Thanks for dropping that on us. Design thinking, such a critical part. It's grown into being such an integral part of the design community, especially like whether you're a product designer, a UX designer, or anything in between. One of the first times I ever came across one of your talks was, I think it was either awards or another conference, but you gave this incredible presentation about the Royal Caribbean. And it's just the visuals, truly one of the best presenters I've seen in a long time. And the question I had after watching that is, obviously you're using a lot of the design thinking framework, but one of the things that left me with is, how did you take Royal Caribbean, such like ambitious and like really lofty goal of what they wanted to accomplish, and also like bring them back down to earth, but also push the limits? I would just love to hear a little bit more if you have any other like little side tidbits of working with Royal Caribbean and how design thinking helped you be successful there.
Yeah, well, no, first of all, Ryan, thank you so much for the compliment there. And you know, the talks I get to do, I think I find myself just getting so passionate up on stage, not only because of the work that I'm proud of myself, but I mean, I'm just so proud of everybody who touched that project. I mean, there was a huge team of people, including myself, but others from Royal Caribbean too. And I would say the first thing it took, honestly, to deliver something that big was just the right team. And if you have people in the room who you trust enough to jump in like head first, And to trust each other that no matter how big the challenge is going to be, that we're going to give it everything and roll up our sleeves to get to that end point together, it just makes it a dream. I think that, I've been many, many places where we go through like big digital transformation projects, and ultimately the success of the project really does come down to the individuals who are working alongside you on it. But I think your question was really insightful, because at the end of the day, what we tried to do was huge. For anyone who's listening, who maybe hasn't seen that talk, or you know, just have any context for Royal Caribbean, they're a cruise company. We embarked with them on a digital transformation project to completely reimagine the entire guest experience and the crew experience, to really kind of re-digitize the entire organization. We worked alongside some incredible executives there who had all come from Disney, and they had obviously big aspirations and big hopes for what they were hoping to do. And I think ultimately, to start off with, it was their ambition and drive from having kind of been at Disney beforehand that got us most excited. I remember walking into that room for the first time and meeting them for the first time, and they said, "Pete, if you ever show us a hamburger menu as part of this project, like if you ever come up with something like that conventional, you're fired." And I think at that moment, I just realized that synergy was right there, because these were people who wanted to do something big. They want to do something bold, ambitious, and ultimately like human-centered. And so taking it back to design thinking and the role that design thinking plays in something as big and as grand as a digital transformation project, if you can really think about a challenge in its entirety, that's one thing. But at the end of the day, it's just about people. And it's just about making sure that those people have the best possible experience they could ever have in their lifetimes when they're engaging with the Royal Caribbean brand. And if you can make it that simple, and if you can place them at the very core of everything that you're doing, then it keeps you laser focused, because some of the big challenges you'll come up against are decisions that you have to make. You have to prioritize, you have to work to a timeline, you've got to choose X technology over Y technology. So coming back to that simple human-centered focus of, well, at the end of the day, our success here isn't on whether we ship it on time. It's whether the person who experiences it comes to life when they experience it. That really does keep you grounded. So that's one thing I would say, is that in amongst all the complexity, having a North Star or a vision that everyone has aligned to begin with is so, so helpful. But I don't know if you can resonate with that, Ryan, but that was certainly super helpful for us.
Yeah, no, I think that that's a brilliant explanation. I'm just curious, was there anything that maybe when you guys early days, maybe it was just, you know, sticky notes and a whiteboard, like a pie in the sky idea that actually never ended up making it into the final product?
Gosh, I mean, these guys are so ambitious that I don't want to ruin the surprise for many of the things that are still coming. Like everything.
Yeah, that's the thing, right? It's like the ideas you can't make in the. Yeah.
They're still funny. Yeah, I think unlike many of our partners where you can have these big, bold, ambitious ideas, but you kind of know that some of them are never going to see the light of day. Honestly, with the Royal Caribbean guys, they're so driven. I wouldn't be surprised if every single one of them like comes to be. Like we literally made Uber for mojitos. Like that's just unbelievable. Like someone will bring you a drink wherever you are on that ship. Like that's insane. Like the feeling when someone brings you that is just unbelievable. So, you know, I have no doubt that these guys are going to continue to do incredible, incredible things. But yeah, no, very cool.
Yeah. Thank you for sharing that. And for anybody that hasn't, you know, make sure you check out that talk. I think you can find it all over YouTube. And then Pete on Twitter is just Pete W Smart. So make sure you check him out. And yeah, he's an awesome, awesome follow on Twitter. And he has a ton of great talks that you can find across the web. So just wanted to give that a shout out, because that's actually how I organically stumbled across you a while back. And it was just a talk that I've always kind of tried to emulate and mirror after, because it was very well done. It's great for designers. It's great for business people. It doesn't really matter what your background is. The story that you tell is super, you know, captivating. So I just wanted to give you a shout out more than anything. But Brendan, back to you, man.
No, that was good. And for those of you guys who are listening, we'll go ahead and put that talk in the show notes. So
All right, rolling back to, I like how you guys get like technical and nerdy. This is why we have the duo, me and Ryan, because I'm like the feeling.
I tend to go down rabbit holes. Brendan's always like pulling me out. He's like Ryan, like we've only been talking for like 10 minutes, and you're getting into like what features did you cut during that
release?
No,
this is why we're
like,
the duo, man.
Yeah,
this is why we're the duo.
Thanks for bringing it back, Brendan. I appreciate it as always, buddy.
There always has to be two types of people, my man. All right, so rolling back, we're gonna Ryan poked some holes. We're going to hop into more of these holes. So I want to go back to the 50 ideas in 50 days and all that traveling you did. And we might even get into that deserted island that you like to talk about. But let's, sure. I want to talk, so let's talk about the 50 ideas in 50 days. Because there's we talk about this a lot. The concept of, you know, the early designer trying to get a job with no portfolio. And a lot of our advice is to constantly make your own projects and not wait for a client to land in your lap. Unless you're like what you did when you're 15 years old, you found a butcher. And if it were me, I'd probably be sweating. I would need to send him an invoice for the amount of sweat in my turtleneck. So how did you come upon the 50 ideas in 50 days? Why did you start it? And what were the what was the result of that? Because you did mention that was a very big turning point that in your career.
Great question. I think one of the things that I've always tried to, because I love meeting young designers. I love finding people who are just really early in their career who still have never lost that passion for what it is they do. Like if you can hold on to that into your career, into like, you know, the 20, 30 years that you know, your design career is gonna have, it is gonna be the difference between coming in every day and this being a job versus the thing that you would still do for free. Like I still have that feeling of I would do what I do for free. Like don't tell anyone that. I mean, I'm actually aware that I'm now announcing that publicly on a podcast. But no, seriously, like if you can maintain like that feeling, it is unbelievable. So I love meeting young designers. And the thing that I would always say is, look, realistically, you are one of 1,000 people who is going to try and get a job at any firm anywhere. And those odds can feel kind of crazy. There is likely a place for you somewhere. But if you want to stand out, you've got to stand out. You've got to almost challenge the brief. And I think the brief that people are often given is, hey, create a portfolio, do some personal projects. And the number of people who are doing that, you can probably imagine the number of people that are going to have very, very similar portfolios to you. So how are you going to stand out? And if you can take a step back and you can challenge the expectations and you can, you know, lift your head up a little bit above the crowd, that's an amazing position to be in. And so I think I've always tried to maintain that philosophy in what it is that I do, trying to push the bar a little bit. I love taking risks and just seeing, you know, what I could potentially do to push the boundaries of either my own understanding of design, my own ability to solve problems. And in this case, it was a combination of all of those things. I was genuinely fascinated in design thinking. And I was genuinely in love with this idea of, well, what can you do with this? Like, what is the limits of design? Because there are some designers who say design will solve the world's problems. And there are some designers who say, like, how arrogant, that's stupid. And I loved that dichotomy. I loved the fact that there was some tension there. But at the same time, I realized that if I could do something big, like 50 problems in 50 days, like that gives me a door to go and have some of those amazing conversations. And so I visited, as part of the journey, 12 or maybe 13 of Europe's top design studios. Like I arranged time to meet with them to seek out their advice and their wisdom on design thinking, to get their views, to kind of feed in. And so then that became the project. And so I put this site up online. Every day there's a different problem. Some days the solutions were great. Some days they sucked. Some days they were just okay. But that the interviews that I was able to have as well, A, made amazing connections that I still have to this day. And B, I think it gave me something at the end, which back to like, I think your original point, Brandon, did give me something that stood out compared to others who were then also kind of trying to get their next job or land their next gig. And so, yeah, I think that's been something that's been really, really impactful in my life. And would definitely encourage anybody who's thinking about, you know, be it transitioning to a new job or just starting out in their career. Yeah, do challenge that brief and that expectation and see what you can do to stand out.
I got one more thing because I know Ryan, you were about to hop in, but I want to know because this is really important. Now that you've mentioned that you arranged time to meet with these top agencies in Europe, how did you go about that? Because now that we kind of are on this road and the people listening are like, okay, he did X, Y, and Z, but how did you feel when you were writing these emails to these people? Did you look up how to email these type of people? What was your thought process of emailing these people, and what did you email these people?
Yeah, I don't think there was much science to it, honestly. Again, like, I was just a tenacious, I'm just a tenacious kid. Like, that was me.
Yeah.
So this idea that, you know, that there was going to be some formulaic way of doing it, or some kind of formal way of introducing myself, I literally just found email addresses on the websites of these companies. I just told them about what I was doing, the fact that I admired them, I would love to meet them. And I think because it had an edge, and I wasn't asking for anything like a job, I was just asking for like 15 minutes, half an hour, a conversation. And of course, I was saying that I was coming in because I admired the company, and I greatly did. And so I think all in all, it felt like a really good way to make some of those connections. And I think you would be surprised. Like, we've hired people who have just tweeted us. We've hired people who have sent us random emails. Like, you'd be surprised where those emails go and who they reach. And I know that we also get a lot of graduates who hit up our email address and, you know, our career site. And, you know, I do see there are so many people out there hustling and doing their thing, which is awesome. Like, keep going. But if you can, again, find that edge, find a way in, even if it's just to ask them advice, get some coffee. People hit me up on LinkedIn all the time. And guys, I love replying. Like, I genuinely love replying. At the end of every one of my talks, I put my personal cell phone number and my email address up on the screen for everybody there. Honestly, for no other reason than just loving to connect with people and loving to connect with people, especially who are coming to design conferences because they've lost that creative spark. Like, they've lost, the reason why they're there is because they're lost. They're looking for that next step. They're in a place where maybe, you know, they've forgotten that initial passion that they had for design. I love meeting those people, not because I've got great advice, not because I've got like great wisdom, but I think like when you can be surrounded by people who are passionate about what it is they do, like that's where math doesn't make sense anymore. And I think that's one of like the, I know we're going to come later in this podcast, I'm sure, to like, you know, things like lessons and things that I've learned over the years. But honestly, like that is the biggest lesson that I've ever learned. I used to be a solo operator, but I used to be someone who, yeah, would, you know, put on a suit, who would, you know, skateboard down to town, ran his own agency, you know, traveled the world as like a solo, like design consultant. But when you are surrounded by people for whom design is still their passion, when you are surrounded by people who are humble, but yet are so talented, somehow math doesn't make any sense anymore, because really like 1 + 1 should equal 2. Like 2 people creating a project, like that should be what it is, right? But when you're around those people and you feel, you yourself feel so inspired to keep going, and by your inspiration and your pushing, they too feel inspired. Somehow like 1 + 1 = 7. Like it doesn't make any sense. But that's why I love meeting people, and I love connecting with people who are super early on in their career, because when you're that passionate and when you love what it is that you do, it's not about necessarily like getting advice at that point. It's just about maintaining that passion and then finding your tribe, like finding the people that are going to sustain that throughout all of your career, be it like a design team or whatever that might be, you know?
Yeah, 100%.
Yeah.
I think like the takeaway of no matter how many podcasts you listen to or books you read about like being more productive or building a good team or having a successful business, it's so funny that one theme that you can almost always pull out is invest in good people as one theme. And the second theme is surround yourself with passionate people. Those two things, if you have those two elements, chances are you're going to be in good shape to build something successful. So I love that story, Pete. I think it makes total sense. And I think that the other thing that I love there was just the hustle aspect. Getting yourself out there, throwing yourself out there, you know, just, you know, the word I like to use is scrappy, just finding opportunities as much as you can. I love that. So I think that's just a great message for everyone. I did want to transition just a sec. So we talk a ton on Design Huddle about skill stacking, just like opportunities to constantly be challenging yourself, whether it's a design, you know, strictly in UX, or maybe it's on business, or maybe it's something on marketing. There's a lot of different ways you can skill stack. So how do you know when to like double down on some of your current skills versus like taking the taking a leap and learning new skills? I think a lot of people struggle with this because the industry is constantly moving. So I'd love to get your take on when to double down on skills and when to take the leap and learn a new skill.
Yeah, no, it's great. I'm sure some of your people that you've chatted with on the podcast here have mentioned like frameworks for stuff like this. The one which is, of course, very famous is IDEO's T-shape for an individual, where you do want to have both breadth, which is like that the crossbar of the T. Imagine that in a typographic terms, then like the stem of the T like is your depth. You do really want to, as a designer, have an area of design where you're really doubling down, where you're really you're driving your expertise, because that will be the thing that ultimately allows you to produce. But the crossbar of that T, these other skills, the things where you're kind of really broadening your awareness or interest and passion and curiosity, those are the things that feed into it. And so I think there's not really an either or. I would say it's very, very, very difficult to be a world-class generalist. I will say that. That's incredibly difficult to do. Again, I'm super, super lucky in the sense that I'm working with team members and designers all around the world who we've handpicked because they are just so good in so many different areas. And I feel so humbled every single day when I work with these people. But I would say they're so rare because it is so difficult to become an expert in every single thing. And I would say, like, find the thing that makes you feel alive. Like, for me, when I first started in my career, like, I was really into illustration and like logo design and typography. Like, those are the things that I loved. And so I would spend hours and hours and hours doubling down on those skills. But at the same time, if I hadn't had broadened my horizons and like curiously looked around at what else was happening in the industry, I wouldn't have discovered things like After Effects, Flash, design thinking, UX design, like when that wasn't even a word, but it was just becoming a thing. And so I would say, even if you have something you're doubling down in today, do keep that curiosity and do keep skilling up, because it might lead you into your next career path, something that you're actually more passionate about as you go. But yeah, that T-shaped model has helped me a lot in my career, and I hope will be helpful for others too.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Love it. So now that we are on the bright side of things, we've for the last 27 minutes, super nice highlights. We're gonna fall off the cliff for a second. No, we're playing. we would love to know. We want to dig into the challenges, whether that be mental, insecurities of whether you were younger. Like, what were the biggest? Because at every changing point, whether that have been when you were doing your 50-50 challenge or during each new phase of your career, what were the biggest challenges for you or the biggest turning points for you? And let's start there.
Yeah, no, it's a great question. And I think that is honestly one of the biggest things that I try and contend with when I go to design conferences. I think there's this kind of mysticism of like this guy on a stage that somehow he has it all figured out. And that is definitely not the case. I would say that there are people who have just found themselves fortunate to work alongside other people who have been fortunate enough to pick up the press and whatever it is, an interest of others. Like that's amazing. But those people are very likely, struggling and also have their own like axe to grind in terms of, trying to work out this thing called design, like trying to find their own way in their career, in their industry still. And I would say, like, if, just kind of taking it back to that like first positive slant of this kid starting out young, I mean, that definitely opens you up to wanting and knowing that, really, if you're putting yourself out there, you're putting yourself out there. And that's great when people pick up your stuff and they love it and they're interested in it. But also, like, when the criticism comes, or when people don't like what it is you do, or they're just at, like, you know, they're just agnostic to it, they don't really care about it, like, that equally can be as impactful, if not more so. I remember when I was first, like, writing design articles, and I still feel this way today. People would leave so many nice comments. The design community is amazing. But I still remember to this day, like, the two or three, like, negative comments that would be put there on my, like, my first articles. Why is that? I don't know why that is, but I think I just, as a human being, and I'm sure I'm not alone, I over-index on criticism, and I therefore, like, my ears become closed to, you know, any kind of positive feedback that might be there. And I think that is a really, really important lesson for so many people. Like, in design, it's not as if what we're creating is just, like, raw materials. We're not in a kind of a factory lineup. We're taking our creative energy and our intelligence and our ideas and the inspiration that we have or whatever else it is, and we're putting it on the page to, you know, for want of a better word, right? And so therefore, like, there is this emotional attachment and this sense of, you know, somehow part of you is in whatever it is that you produce. And so therefore, being able to separate yourself from work is something that so many designers I know have struggled with. I struggled with early in my career as well. It can mean that you know, taking criticism is really, really hard. I certainly found it hard when I was first starting out. But of course, like, you learn that at the end of the day, it's not about you. And I think that the big lessons that I had to learn in my career were, it's not about you. Like, it's not about, like, your ideas versus others' ideas. It's not about, like, you being the expert versus not. Honestly, like, the biggest lesson that I learned early in my career was that the best thing you can hope for as a designer is to be a curious idiot. Like, if you can master the art of being a curious idiot, you are going to be an exceptional designer, because an exceptional designer doesn't have all the answers. In fact, they make a living out of knowing no answers, but they have this curiosity and this drive to discover insights and to ask stupid questions, which sometimes result in surprisingly stupid answers that unlock new insights. And I think if you can posture yourself in that way and learn that lesson early in your career and not strive to be seen as, like, the number one designer on, like, Behance or Dribbble or any one of these platforms, or to be seen as, like, the world leading designer in your firm, those can be traps. Like, those can be things that can derail you from actually focusing on what really, really matters, which is, it's about the people that you're serving. It's about the users that you're creating for. And the best possible thing that you can do to create the world's best products and services is just be an idiot. Like, just be curious and just try and have empathy for their world, and don't assume that you have the answers yet. So yeah, I definitely struggled with that when I was kind of early in my career. And yeah, lessons that I had to learn. Definitely the criticism and, you know, like, the, like, putting yourself out there and putting yourself into your work was all kind of bundled up into it as well. But yeah, man, I mean, it's never an easy road, right?
Yeah. Pete, can you talk a little bit about, like, along the same lines in terms of, like, career development, can you talk a little bit about how you transitioned from being, like, an individual traveling the world, working with all these companies, to being a leader? Like, I'd love to hear about, like, your role at Fantasy, you leading a team. Just how did you transform from being someone that's really kind of just focused on themselves and just contributing, and you're managing your own world, and then you're responsible for other people and their well-being and growing a culture. So love to hear anything on that.
It's a great question, because there's no course that sets you up to be a design leader in our industry. There is literally only experience. And I think that I found a mentor, like, midway into my career. And if I could change anything about, you know, my path, it would have been to have found that mentor earlier in my career, because their advice and their insight, I think, would have changed my life much, much sooner. Because design experience does not equal design leadership. Like, they're completely different things. You know, to your point, Ryan, like, being an individual contributor means that you're someone who is striving to have the best insights. You're striving to produce the best possible work. But as a design leader, it's a completely different mentality. You're somebody who, you know, you're no longer the originator of the ideas. You're this facilitator, and you're the mission driver. and you're in total service of other people and helping them have those ideas. Like you're the mathematician who ultimately is trying to make maths break. Like you're the one who, you know, back to my earlier reference of like, you know, 1 + 1 + 1 = 7, you're the person who's trying to create the environment for that to happen, for a great output to be produced by individuals as part of your team. And so that shift in mentality from being the person responsible for the output to being the person responsible for others and giving them that environment is a big, big shift. And I wish that there was like a course or a module that you do like early in your career that teaches you about that. I wish there was, but the best thing to learn, I think, is just to have a mentor, have others who are ahead of you and try and pick up what you can from them.
Love it. And I think I couldn't agree more that there's no course, right? A lot of this you're figuring out. I'm sure, like, as you mentioned, you've made mistakes, you've gotten feedback, and you just continually get better. So having that mindset is also, like, you know, so key to success.
Yeah, yeah. And I would say, like, you've got to have real humility. Like, there's a wonderful book I would recommend. I don't know if you're into kind of book recommendations, but there's one called Leaders Eat Last. It's Simon Sinek. And I think it really speaks to the idea of what makes a great leader. I believe it's the Navy or the U.S. military. It is the person in charge of that particular division who eats last because his team comes first or her team comes first. And that really is the role of a leader. You've got to have incredible humility and you've got to be self-sacrificial to a certain extent. I like to think that you're providing a platform for others to do their career's greatest work. And that does take burying your own ego and making sure that you are there for others. And so, you know, I like to take this model of leaders eating last into my day-to-day by saying, when I walk into the studio on a Monday morning, the greatest thing I can do is be there for other people. It is to serve them, to be available to them, to answer their questions, to help unblock them. And like, there's a bunch of stuff that I have to do too. Like there is a bunch that, you know, comes with like running a like global design consultancy, but that's the stuff that waits to the end of the day because my first responsibility is always to the team and making sure that I'm elevating them to the level that allows them to continue to produce the amazing work that Fantasy produces.
Excellent. So now that we're on the topics of design leaders, and I know in talking about the, basically you are running with the vision and you also do talk a lot about vision. So I kind of want to talk, this goes back to, we're referencing the talk that we have in the show that we're going to have in the show notes. So I want to get into, in this talk, you were talking about how you basically have to run a team and have them match the vision that you're trying to go with. Again, that project with, I forget the name of the, my coffee's running out. Guys, the funny thing here is that Pete is now just coming back from Korea. I'm still fainting because I'm just last week came from Adobe Max and I'm still like panting.
I'm all the way up. I'm just continually crushing it. So no excuses on my end.
Yeah. Ryan's holding the table stakes up. So tell us a little about how you feel others can uphold vision and really just hold their team to creating something great. I know you guys have a saying, you're 30% wrong over at Fantasy. So tell us a little about how you hold a team to the biggest vision possible. And I know a lot of things don't see the light of day, but how do you keep everybody to such a high standard?
Yeah. No, it's a great question. Yeah, the phrase that we use, a 7 out of 10 means that you're 30% wrong. We don't say that because we're high and mighty. It just means that as people and as individuals, like that is not our aspiration to produce 7 out of 10 experiences. Our aspiration is to produce the world's best. And again, we don't really care about like being the world's number one. Like we are in so many different categories, but that's never been the driving force. We always take it back to why. Like what is the big why? Why every single one of us got into this industry? And it is to create things that change people's lives. And when you meet designers, often what you'll hear them say, especially when they're early in their career, is like, what do you want to do with design? Like, what do you want to go and do with this amazing gift, this amazing power that you've now got? And they'll say, I want to go and change people's lives. And I think what I feel so bad about is that I meet designers who then go out into their careers and they're in roles where they feel like they've lost that ability and that influence to do so. And what I love to remind people always is, number one, like, that was the why. That was the why that you got started with. And number two, remind them of the incredible power that they do have in producing experiences that are genuinely going to touch the lives of hundreds, if not thousands, if not millions of people on a day-to-day basis. And to contextualize it just for a second, like, people are going to use your stuff for, like, it's something staggering, like 41% of their waking life, they're gonna be in front of a screen. That's an insane amount of life. The stuff that you're making is gonna be used by those people, and you're actually going to impact them on a day-to-day basis. That is insane. Therefore, what are you gonna do with that privilege? Like, what are you gonna do with that responsibility? And if you can come back to that why for a second, it allows you then to have a vision. It allows you to say, well, then for those individuals, what must we do? And it then, I think, allows you to ask some of those bigger and bolder questions, like, what if we did this for them? What if we did that? Because at the end of the day, every business, the end result is profit, but only because you have done something in service of other people. And the businesses that are really successful are just the ones who are really, really, really good at doing things in service of others. And so as designers, that is our role. It's this marriage of business need, business requirements, but also user need. And so that Royal Caribbean example is another one, but we work with, like, amazing companies. We're working with Tesla, Netflix, like George Lucas right now, 23andMe, like all of these companies, they're amazing, right? But at the end of the day, it's just people. We're just trying to serve these people. And if we can craft a vision around what experience we want to make for these people, again, you can start to make a North Star. And the term that we do like to use is, we hate the term MVP. It's a terrible, terrible term. It trains you to think about, you know, it's like if you're Ferrari, like, what's an MVP of a Ferrari? It's like an engine, a chassis, and some, like, wheels, and it moves. But that's not a Ferrari. Like, the Ferrari is an experience. It is so much more than just getting something out onto the road. We like to use this term MLP. Like, what is a minimum lovable product? And again, if you can focus what it is that you're creating and putting it out into the world on serving people's functional needs, but then also giving to them something that they're not only going to use, but actually benefit from and love, that's when you build affinity. That's when the services and products that you're building somehow transcend the plethora of other competing services, which I'm sure are out there in the industries that everyone is designing for. You've got to make things that connect with people on a more human level. And so, yeah, we use that term MLP, and I think it really helps us as we craft, like, what should be part of our vision, like, what is going to be there in this first release. Yeah, it's definitely difficult to do. I don't want to make it sound trivial, but at the same time, these are some of the things that we try and encourage people to think about on a day-to-day basis.
I definitely agree with everything you said. And I really like how you take the opposite approach to everything in a story or a conversation. You have to take a extreme in order for somebody to even listen. So I love the opposite side of the spectrum, where it's just like, you have a gift. You're spending so much time on serving others. So why not come out the gate swinging and do something awesome? So, and guys, by the way, you should know you should know Fantasy. I've basically plugged all their stuff on my Instagram, to be honest. So you guys do excellent work. You guys, actually, let's pause. So George Lucas,
yeah,
I'm a fan really quick.
Sure.
You guys are going to fix the Star Wars series, right?
Oh, no, we're not working on Star Wars. No. He is working on an awesome, awesome new project. We're super, super privileged to be working directly with him right now. But we've worked with Steven Spielberg. We worked with the Academy of Motion Pictures. I mean, when you do good work, like, your name gets passed around. We've never had a sales team in 20 years. Like, that's the real story. Like, everything has come down to being, like, passionate about what we do, and just being super ambitious. And then if you can deliver on that, like, people see your stuff. Like, thank you so much, Brandon, for sharing our stuff. That is awesome. Like, you are our sales team. I appreciate that, man. Thank you.
Wow, that is you're welcome. No, that is absolutely, yeah, this is the absolute opposite, because, again, I'm very process oriented, and again, I'm very in line of thought of always over delivering. But not having a sales team, because that's a process that you would think, or I would think, would need in place for at least something to be consistent. But I guess the consistency here is that you guys really put your eggs, those eggs that would be in the sales team, all those eggs into really good people who are absolutely talented in creating really good products. So that just goes to show, guys, I'm just brain vomiting here. It doesn't matter where you put your eggs in the basket. It's just double down on whatever it is. So whether that's a skill in terms of what we're talking about here, it's, you know, fantasy skill is producing highly quality products, and they're known for that. If you're known for it, just as you would be known for illustration, or I would be known as running my mouth, I may not be the best designer, but I do sure have a personality. So all right, so segueing into what, out of all the things, because you just name dropped a million things on top of what we started off with today, what haven't you done that you would like to touch?
I don't know. I mean, when I was starting out, literally this idea that one day my work, like that I had produced, would be like in someone's hand was literally insane. I was just so excited by this notion, and like to work with the local butcher was like literally the greatest day of my life. And so you can imagine, like, when you're first starting to work with Google and Samsung and, you know, George Lucas and the UFC and all these people, like, I still have that childlike feeling every single time we work with an amazing, amazing company. But we've worked with companies, honestly, that we had never heard of. And, you know, to a certain extent, like, you know, you might not hear about for the next like year or so because they're still so young. But I think what we're really, really drawn to, and certainly what I'm really drawn to, is ambition. Like, people who want to do something big in the world, for whom like 7 out of 10 like isn't good enough. They want to produce something that is going to drive like real growth for their business, real impact, going to transform an industry. And so when we started working with 23andMe, who are this medical company here in the States, I don't know if, you know, the listeners here will have heard of them. I'm sure many of them will. No one had heard of 23andMe. They were a fantastic product, but they hadn't become mass market yet. And the privilege there was, it's not about the brand. It wasn't about like the name. It was just the level of ambition and the real kind of human-centered focus that we experienced when we met that team was just absolutely addictive. And I think that that's what I long for every single day, is to be around people, be it the team at Fantasy or the partners that we work with, who are just so passionately in love with doing something impactful in the world that it just makes you want to be better. Like, it reminds you every day of why it is you're even doing what you're doing. So it doesn't really matter to me if it's like Nike tomorrow, if it's like Adidas. Like, it doesn't, at this point, like, the brand name doesn't really matter. I just love,
your list is already too long.
Yeah. Like, it's the opportunity, and it's the big dream of what it is we're going to create together. But hey, like, you know, we work with Elon Musk, maybe one day SpaceX, that would be pretty cool.
That would be awesome. Colonizing Mars with Fantasy. No, I really do appreciate that. So there's not like a specific technology that you want to touch, like something in AR. There's not like, ooh, that's the new technology I want to get my hands on. So technology-wise, from a big idea, yeah. I got you. From like, I just want to make cool shit. But is there something that you haven't touched? I know your work is very diverse.
Yeah.
Is there something you want to touch a little bit more on? Or you're just like, the technology's not there yet, but as soon as it is, we going in.
Oh, that's great. I mean, I thought this way for so long around like autonomous vehicles and like AI, machine learning. Right now, we're working in all of these spaces, which is honestly amazing. I do feel like on days that I'm in some kind of Tom Hanks sci-fi movie. You know, right now we're working with loads of like automotive companies on autonomous vehicles, which is insane. We're working with big operating system companies on artificially intelligent driven operating systems. Like, one of my favorite films a few years ago was this movie Her, with Joaquin Phoenix and Scarlett Johansson. It's an incredible, incredible film, and it's so well conceived. And there's, as a designer, it's just an amazing movie to see someone's vision for the future of human computer interaction. It's insane. So when that first came out, I was so excited that one day I would maybe have that opportunity to do that. And yeah, today we are, and that is fantastic. honestly, I think when I will be most excited is when we can solve things like conferencing systems, and we can work with holograms and kind of, you know, transport our like physical presence into other places, not just doing it in AR or virtual reality. That would be pretty insane. Like when the technology is there for that, like I would love, love, love to design those kind of experiences, like the haptics around that, like actually making it feel like you're in place in a different part of the universe or space. Like that would be pretty insane for sure.
Please do. I would love to not leave my room. I just watched a YouTube video of a guy wearing a VR headset for a week straight. Very interesting. I will also put that in the show notes. No, I'm playing. But it was very interesting. So,
what were the insights? How did he find it?
He said he felt like his room was a spaceship and he had no contact with anybody. And for entertainment, he basically, I forget even the video game, he basically attended yoga sessions in VR. And yeah, he said it was very disturbing. He felt very, he lost all track of time. But he didn't really have like a very extreme feeling about it. He just felt very isolated. Yeah. But he also, he felt like he could control his emotions a lot better. So like he was pissed or whatever, he could put himself in like a nice solitude environment and like put on some nice soft music.
Really?
So it was interesting. He brought, I think at the end of the video, he brought a, it was very good for like therapeutic.
Yeah. Fascinating. Really, really fascinating. Sort of, there you go. I would love to chat with that guy.
Yeah. I wonder what it was like when he came out. That's probably a video we have to watch.
Yeah, for sure.
But one last question to end it off. If your child decided to go into design or whatever it is, what would you tell them as they were learning, falling, failing? How would you encourage them to keep doing what they're doing?
Yeah, I mean, I would definitely always want the best for my son, right? I genuinely want the best for so many young designers who are coming out of school or just kind of really early in their career, because I mean, we've all been there. That's the one thing that everyone in this industry has in common, is that when we were first starting out, having somebody to like reach out to and seek advice from was huge. It was absolutely unbelievable. And so I would say to him and to anybody else who is kind of just starting out, finding others who are a little bit further ahead than you can be so life-changing. And when I say further ahead than you, I mean, yeah, try and target the CEO or like the global head of product or whoever, like from a company. Like you might struggle a little bit, but like you can even find people who are just an intern or who are junior or who are an intermediate at a company, in a product company, in a startup, in an agency or a product team or whatever it might be. And just take them out for coffee. Like, be somebody who likes making connections like early in your career, because when you can make those connections and actually experience things in real terms, like outside the classroom, you know, outside of an environment where, you know, things are theory, but actually in the real, like nitty gritty of real life, and actually find out what that's all about and learn from those people, it is invaluable. I would definitely say that experience beats theory. There is so much that I learn and that many people will continue to learn when they go to design school. There's amazing courses that are out there. You know, everything from like AIGA courses through to, you know, Skillshare courses online. Like, they're fantastic, but nothing is going to beat the like real world hands-on experience. Those classes are fantastic for doubling down on your craft, like learning the intricacies of typography. That's where you want to, like, if I was telling my son, like, I would say, like, practice, practice, practice your craft. Drill down, as Ryan, you were mentioning, like, drill down into the things that you are passionate about and just try and become the best at whatever it is that you do, whatever that craft is, be it user research, be it like ethnographic studies, be it like illustration, typography, like motion design, whatever that is, like, drill down and practice that. Find, you know, things that you can try and emulate and try and work out how they did it so you can learn some of those skills. But at the same time, the craft and the practice is only going to get you so far. Like, putting that craft and that practice into a real world environment is going to teach you huge amounts. So yeah, find people who are ahead of you, seek out those opportunities, see if you can, you know, get some of those real world experiences, and don't like jump and like hold on to one thing really early in your career. There are so many different paths and ways that design can take you. you will be so surprised where you've ended up in 5 years. No one can really predict it. So if it doesn't work out and you end up in a job that you're not loving for the first year, don't panic. Don't worry about it. Like, you will find your way. You will find those people. You will make those connections. And you will work your way towards something where you feel, A, super happy, but then B, really surprised, because there is no path. There is no, like, one way of doing this. And that, I think, again, is the common thing when you meet designers. Everyone has come from a different background. Nobody has this figured out. Everyone's kind of looking ahead and trying to work out, hey, how can I be better? And that never, never leaves you. So, no, keep going would be my advice.
Love it. I can't say it any better. So we're going to end it right there. Thank you, Peter, so much. And in closing, where can the people find you? Where do you want them to look? And we'll close it out there.
Sure. Well, obviously, go and check out the work. If you don't know Fantasy, over at fantasy.co, you can come and chat with me anytime. I'm over at Pete W. Smart on Instagram and Twitter and all those kind of places. So, no, I would love to chat with anybody, any one of these listeners out here who is thinking about their next step. And I would love to provide anything that I can to help you guys out. And yeah, Brandon, Ryan, thank you so much for your time. You guys do amazing work. You are such phenomenal hosts as well. It's been a pleasure talking to you both.
Design Huddle is a podcast that is hosted by Ryan Warner and Brendan Gross. The opinions stated here are our own and not those of our company. Thank you for tuning in, and please feel free to share this episode.